Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With a stupid Ewok head.
Blabber on him, Knowlesy.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker.
Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Hello and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where we're rising up back on the street and ready to limp our way to Dungeness Power Station. I'm Adam Brooks and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
I'll get him later in the men's by gently pushing him against a urinal while he pees.
Nick Alder.
Sorry, Kelly, but you're about to be breakfast for the coastal cat of Kent.
And Tom Stab.
You're an Arab. You are. You're an Arab.
So, here we go. Chapter 29?
Yes, chapter 29. Hard shoulder, sore foot. We have a bit of a walk update, I believe.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I tried tracking Alan's day-by-day journey progress, tallying it up with the information he gives us in the book, and I have to say, I got to chapter 29, and it was quite frustrating, because at this point, things don't tally, and they don't make sense. If you pick through all the information that he gives us, we should be on day 13, which should be a Thursday at the beginning of chapter 29. He should be doing East Grinstead to what I would guess might be maybe Ashurst, because I was looking for a town or a village that would be 5 miles away from Royal Tunbridge Wells, because Alan does say that he's dropping to 5 miles or below. So based on that guesswork, day 14 would be 5 miles Ashurst to Royal Tunbridge Wells. Day 15 would be around 5 miles Royal Tunbridge Wells to the Trickle Brook Fishery, which does exist. But then the rest of it really doesn't make sense, because that would put you on to day 16 and he's somehow getting from the Trickle Brook Fishery all the way to Lid-on-Sea, close to Dungeness, which means he would have to cover 55 miles in that Sunday, because he would go from the fishery to Ashford, which he references. That in itself is 28 miles away. He'd have to go from Ashford to the Channel Tunnel, which is a further 13 miles. And in the book, he's there at about Sunday lunchtime. He'd then also have to go from the Channel Tunnel to Lid-on-Sea, which would be another 14 miles to take him up to Sunday evening. So essentially, unreliable narrator. After about the first 12 days, none of this adds up.
He's descended into baffling nonsense.
Well, that's the thing. You basically got sections where he's blacking out and doesn't really know where he is or what's going on.
So, yeah, because it is nonsense, because he's saying that because of his maimed foot, he's down from 20 miles a day to 5 miles a day. Yeah. So there's no way he's covering all of that distance, so we don't really know what's going on. Although at the beginning of the chapter, when we rejoin Alan, he does say he's doing some of the finest strolling of his career.
I feel like he would say that.
Yeah, and he tells us that the additional miles he's done going via London is 120 miles. His original walk, 160.
Yeah, but he had a really great detail.
He had a lovely time in Royal Tunbridge Wells, or Roytonwell.
Yep.
where he said the last of the working classes were driven out sometime in the late 1960s, and you can really sense that feeling of safety as you walk on the high street.
Alan references one of our favourites, again, CFAX. In regards to what Sky did with their coverage of the Formula One and made it so stat heavy, it resembles the mix option of CFAX. I don't remember what the mix option was. Does anyone have anything on that?
Yes, you essentially could turn off the black background, so you'd have text, the characters over the picture.
I do remember that.
Rendering it quite hard to read.
Yeah, a pointless feature. Yeah.
Unpleasurable to thine eye.
Indeed.
Yeah. He's listening to some local radio, and like he says, you can tell by the smile in the DJ's voice that it's one of those whose name sounds like a panty liner, Dream or Breeze or Shape or Silk or something. I thought that's good because he's named his own radio station in that list.
And does that mean we should have had another quiz, radio station or panty liner?
Save it for the next series.
So we get some Denise info now.
This is a great story.
Yes, yeah, so Alan tells a story of how he took a teenage Denise to Radio Norwich for the day for a bit of work experience. Helm a phone in on same-sex marriage. She struggled to calm an irate Catholic and basically went to pieces.
There's a sting in the tail to this, though, because he later informs her that she hadn't even been on air. The Catholic was an actor friend of his, which seemed to upset her more, if anything. But Alan felt it important to show her that live radio is not as easy as her school friends seem to think. And perhaps she should ask them to show a little more respect when they're next round.
Yep, and Alan suddenly realises he's forgotten about work. At this point, it's Saturday tea time, and Alan's back on the mic 10 a.m. Monday morning. So he decides his quickest route is via the M20. So basically, he's walking down the hard shoulder. It's gone midnight, and we find out now that he's hopping.
It's a very sorry sight. Alan doesn't paint a particularly good picture of himself, but I can only imagine what this must look like. Alan hopping down the hard shoulder of the M20, desperately trying to complete a walk in aid of his father.
Also using his arms as indicators.
Yeah. I like the bit he wrote about Dave Clifton as well. My listeners have been in the hands of Dave Clifton for 2 weeks now, and I know for a fact that his shtick will be wearing seriously thin.
Not only will he look a sorry sight based on what we think at the moment, we also find out that because it's nighttime and he hasn't got a high-vis jacket, he's basically found a cat's eye and he can't hold it because he's so fevered that he's carrying his coat, jumper and shirt, so he's shirtless now, and that the only way to protect himself is to walk backwards with the cat's eye in his mouth. It's uncomfortable and tastes of carriageway.
This reminds me a lot of when we were trying to draw the logo for Footsteps of My Father a few weeks ago, like the details that just get thrown in as you go.
It just keeps getting worse.
His foot's got worse as well. He said it's definitely become infected, whether from the stick that cut it or the damp old bread that I found in the park. I know not. I thought... The damp old bread will be it, yeah.
I think it's worth actually reading the description here as well.
That, yeah,
at this point, the foot is swollen and emitting a kind of yellow gel. I guess you could call it foot tripe, while, and this might be my imagination, audibly humming with germs. And there's another one that follows this quite swiftly. I swear it's developed its own pulse, a rhythmic throb that seems for all the world to be spelling help antibiotics in Morse code. I think before we get to the Channel Tunnel, my other highlight here is that Alan writes, I haven't eaten in over a day, and the only drink I've had is a bottle of warm apple juice a lorry driver threw out of his window. Thank you, whoever you are. Bliss.
Was it apple juice?
I don't think it was it?
So things take a rather dramatic turn at this point, and Alan has somehow managed to find his way into the Channel Tunnel. I did have a look and see if that was possible, and basically found a load of very quite sad stories about people trying to get from France to the UK in the Channel Tunnel and how it doesn't end particularly well. By this point, things have gone very, very wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Alan writes that it's chilling to think how easily I almost trafficked myself. If a man like me can almost smuggle himself cross-border without even intending to, then how piddle easy must it be to achieve if you're actually trying? But what you're saying, Stab, is you're debunking that theory. It's not piddle
easy. Well, I don't know, because there are some stories of... I found a story online where a man appeared in court yesterday after making an astonishingly dangerous walk through the Channel Tunnel to France in his flip-flops.
The important detail, the flip-flops there.
Yeah.
I mean, to test it out, we could send Jed to the Channel Tunnel.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, okay.
We'll report back next series.
Off you go. Off you go. We'll take it from here. See ya.
Thanks, mate.
What a fun line in this article you're reading that says, the vacuum effect created by Eurostar Express would normally suck up and kill anyone walking through the tunnel.
Wow.
Lovely stuff.
Sleep well, Greg.
Nice safety feature there.
Yeah.
Don't worry, if anyone does try it, they'll just be sucked into a vacuum.
And killed.
Great.
So normally you wouldn't be able to get anywhere near that, but apparently there was a brief malfunction in the systems of surveillance that allowed him to get into
you
the
mean
tunnel.
The night watchman was asleep?
I haven't got anything else really on this chapter.
I think that pretty much wraps up the chapter, to be honest.
Yeah, on to chapter 30.
Rising up, back on the street. Which is, of course...
Eye of the Tiger.
Eye of the Tiger, yes. Which is, of course, from Rocky 3.
Yes, I thought it was Rocky 3 as well.
Which one's Rocky 3?
Where he fights Mr. T.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
Pity the fool. So this chapter opens with Alan talking about the crawl YouTube clip. Have we all seen that video, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah. Through gritted teeth.
Yeah. So for people who haven't seen it, it's a video of Sian Welsh and Wendy Ingraham, who are both highly decorated triathletes. And they basically were doing an Ironman race. And by the time they get to 140 miles, I think it was, basically their legs have shut down and they're struggling to get over the line. Alan says, I think the video is meant to celebrate the triumph of the human spirit, but good God, it is one of the funniest things I have
ever
seen.
I was going to
say,
much like Sean, I was in pieces watching this video.
But what is
brilliant,
what is brilliant about that is that they're competing for fourth place. Like, they don't even get a place on the podium.
And yeah, so the void between the fact that you're supposed to take this video quite seriously and it's two people having quite a harrowing time, Alan basically commentating it in the book like he's presenting You've Been Framed.
When he says it, well, it's like howled with laughter, yeah.
You can imagine this being read out as if it was commentary on the video. It's like, they're meters from the tape and determined to scoop gold, but after jogging for 100 miles, their legs have other ideas.
Alan says that a friend of his took the video and added the theme to Steptoe and Son. By the way, that is an actual video on YouTube that someone has done. And in the description, it says, thanks to Alan Partridge for the idea. Also, this is just a bit of fun. All respect to these amazing athletes.
Yeah.
So if you search for it, the second video result will be to the theme of Steptoe and Son that someone's made after reading Nomad, basically.
Do you want another foot injury description at this point?
Yeah, go for it.
Is my bloated hiking shoe leaving a trail of gunk behind it like a leather snail? Yes, absolutely.
So yeah, he's a bit delirious by this point, imagining the part of the UK he's in looks like a cat's face in profile on Google Maps, and also trading his watch for some Rolos when he can't remember his PIN.
I mean, I'd really like the detail that he can't stop laughing at this point as well. He's literally lost his mind.
Yeah, and in the book, you'll find that there is a little map of the southeast of England where Alan has drawn a sort of lines around the coast, and it does look a bit like a cat's head in profile. So yeah.
Some lovely minor details around this point as well, where he says, in reference to the crawl video, did it really matter who won the 1997 female Ironman sick world championship? Of course not. It's almost literally a non-event. And he then goes on to describe Martin Luther King Jr. He says, Martin Luther King's son, Martin Luther King Jr.
Just to go back to the watch quickly, it turns out that it's a fake from China, but Alan does say that he has a genuine Rolex Submariner as worn by Connery.
Of course it's a Connery model, isn't it?
Did a bit of Googling. There are different kinds of Submariner watch, but it looks
Submariner.
Like they... Submariner. And it looks like they cost between $5,500 up to $28,000. Even the cheapest one on eBay is $3,500, and the highest one on eBay, £75,000.
Wow. So here's my working theory. He's got a drawer full of fake Rolexes, which he gives to workmen as gifts, and he's got a fake one on his wrist, which he pretends is different and real.
Yeah.
And
unless if he bought that when he was still getting some good BBC money.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Maybe. Yeah. Also, yeah, it says that he uses Google Maps. So how has he gone so wrong on his walk if he's literally got Google Maps to use?
Well, he started with the AA route planner, didn't he? But he's obviously now switched to Google Maps.
And I think he's delirious with infection by this point.
Yeah, good point.
Should be using Apple Maps as well.
I definitely shouldn't.
So he's really struggling at this point, so he turns to music, which has always been there for him. But unfortunately, his playlist, Alan's Belters, isn't on his iPhone. Now, this comes back to a point that I made in an earlier episode where at one point where he does go to listen to music, there is loads of music on there for him to listen to. So at some point between then and now, it's all gone. He blames his assistant, but is it actually Alan's fault?
But it perhaps, if you want to argue this isn't an error, although I think you're right, it might be because the specific playlist Alan's belters that is going to pull him out of this funk, that's what he's looking for on that specific playlist, isn't there?
Right.
Or was his phone stolen by Brian/teenagers and he's bought a replacement that doesn't have the music on it?
It's the sort of thing where actually that might have happened and it's a whole detail he hasn't bothered to explain in the book as well. But no, actually, no, that doesn't make sense because then he's still blaming Lynn for having not put the playlist on. So
there is no music on there because he says there's only one track on his iPhone, a voice memo of his assistant attempting to sing I Dreamed a Dream.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. So him buying a new phone doesn't check out because unless if when you get a new iPhone, it has a voice memo of Lynn singing on it.
That casts her in quite a sort of Susan Boyle capacity, which I do think is very Lynn appropriate.
After dreaming a dream in which I dismiss her, I limp forward.
Are we going to cover Hadaway at all?
Please, I'm also keen to discuss Alan's belters and potentially Lynn's belters as well.
Yep. Well, shall I start with Hadaway?
Yep.
There's just a funny little footnote here where Alan references a story where in 2008, I spotted Hadaway in a hotel steam room. I strode over, introduced myself and said I wanted him to sing on a jingle I'd written. The sessions went badly. It was only when I visited the same hotel and saw him dredging the pool that I realised it wasn't Hadaway, just a man who worked for Jury's Inn.
That is so good.
So good. Followed up by him saying as well, kids' birthday party, hands up who's heard of Dire Straits.
The sort of birthday party that I think we'd all like to attend.
So I think we're going to put together a little Alan's Belters playlist for the socials.
I think we absolutely should. So if anybody out there is listening to us whilst walking, as soon as you finish the episode, if you want to put a bit of a spring in your step, there'll be a great playlist for you to listen to.
I think there might be a genuine grammatical error here as well, because he says, I quickly look at my iPhone for the playlist I've called Alan's Belters, and then he puts, it says, but Alan's Belters isn't there. There's an apostrophe in the second Belters, not in the first. Ah. So arguably, not the beautifully punctuated by Partridge. Yeah.
Have you been waiting like 9 episodes to make that point?
I did think if they're going to say that, I'm going to have to check for punctuation.
It looks like you've circled that 100 times on the page.
Yeah.
Absolutely furious.
I've also drawn a big arrow, just put error.
Should you start a sentence with but?
No.
So, bombshell time. Alan is a granddad. Did we know this already? I don't think we did.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think we knew that Fernando had a child.
No. So he accidentally calls Fernando and we learn that he has a baby and that Carol helps out. So obviously Carol's involved, but Alan no way involved at all.
I also enjoy that he refers to the child as the infant, not by name, you know, not the gender. No,
but is that because he doesn't know?
Well, either way, I think you'd provide more detail or more perspective or insight if you didn't have access rather than just saying Carol helps out with the infant.
It's also made clear that he hasn't met Fernando's baby or Fernando's wife. Comments. I'd love to meet him one day and your lovely wife. Sorry.
And he takes a guess at her name as well.
Fernando says, I'd love to meet him one day and your lovely wife. India, and he says, I exhale with sudden relief. I was this close to calling her Africa.
So his phone battery goes dead and Alan finds himself in rural wilderness. 3 hours later, he hadn't dare move.
Oh, and his foot at this point is throbbing like a frog's neck. Lovely.
So, yeah, he goes into survival mode a bit here and gets up and discovers that he's reached the perimeter fence of the power station. And then this sort of weird delusion dream about Julia Bradbury happens with Claire Balding and Portillo making an appearance and then meeting Jesus. I don't like this section at all. I think it's a bit...
It's one of the weaker things, isn't it?
I think, this section.
I do think it's better. The sections of this book I like most are the ones that are tethered uncomfortably to reality. Even if you know his version of events isn't right, the level of detail is very specific.
Once you go into a dream state, it kind of loses. I think that the humour is lost because it's you could say anything in a dream, whereas when it's grounded in reality, it's more plausible.
Anything could happen. And I think they could have maybe played with this dream scenario a bit differently, because I think they're almost trying to make you think, or is this actually happening to Alan? But, you know, you have the dead giveaway that Julia Bradbury turns up, approaches him and kisses him full on the mouth. It's like, that wouldn't happen in the reality of the APU. Mm. So there's the giveaway straight away that there's no chance that this is actually real.
It did remind me a little bit of the scene in Alpha Papa where you have him, you know, the multiple Alans going, Jason Argonaut. Argonaut.
Yeah. Although you do get some bonus references to Tiny Temper, Tommy Trinder and Tanika Tikaram, but I think he gets cut short.
Right. Who are they?
I don't know who Tommy Trinder is, to be honest. I mean, surely you know who Tiny Temper is, for a start.
Yeah, it was the other two I wasn't so sure about.
Two other bits that I like in this kind of dream fantasy sequence before we before Alan basically ends up in hospital is it Portillo saying, by the way, I walked from Vienna. I didn't even get the train and cannot believe how straightforward it was. And Alan also writing, I lie there, eyes closed, listening to the sound of the sea, which I have to say is one of the most boring sounds there is. He hates nature. And I think that you get that quite a few times in this book where, you know, whether he's annoyed about a bird making noise, he thinks the sound of the sea is boring. So he's taken on board a walk in the footsteps of his father, but he hates walking and he hates being in the great outdoors.
So next, Alan awakes in hospital. It's because he's been found babbling incoherently and asking God if he should take his walk directly to Netflix, which I quite like. Again, I'm not such a fan of this bit, so I haven't really got any notes until he escapes.
No, only a couple of life details, like he's got Lynn listed as his next of kin, but he says it's through expediency rather than affection, I assure you.
And he writes, they had to drain the foot, which isn't a phrase I've ever hankered to hear, which I think we can all agree with.
So he spins a yarn and says that he needs to go for a cigarette and heads out and escapes. And he heads back to North Norfolk Digital, North Norfolk's best music mix, easy for me to say. And 3 hours later, he's back on the air. So he makes it back in time.
That's pretty much the only part of this story that's happened on schedule, isn't it? Him getting back to the show. And then dedicates a song to his assistant, presumably reads her name out on air, but for the purposes of the book, it's been replaced with just the words her name.
Yeah, oh, you know what? I just think about this the other day. I think somebody got in touch with a theory that in the APU, the way Alan has written this book, their suggestion was that he's basically done a find and replace. So whenever Lynn's name is mentioned, it's literally find Lynn replaced with my assistant, which I thought was quite a nice idea. Because I think there are some points in across both of the books where it doesn't really grammatically make sense. Mm. So something like, hey, my assistant's name. Grammatically, maybe if you write, hey, my assistant, or I don't know, I can't quite, there are probably better examples, but I thought that was quite a nice idea that he's kind of just before publication, he's gone, actually, I don't want Lynn's name in this publication.
And not only does he not want her name in, but it's an act of laziness the way he's replaced it. He's not gone through and done it in context.
And I think one final point, particularly about the fact that this is the one thing that's happened on schedule on time in this journey. So this really highlights why tracking his journey progress day by day all falls apart, because this is now, he's on air Monday morning. So that the whole thing about when he starts highlighting it's Saturday lunchtime, it's Sunday tea time, there is no way that he could have covered the actual distance and ended up even near to the Channel Tunnel, let alone Dungeness, in any kind of reality.
He was doomed from the start.
So is it time to head back to the pool?
Yes, I think we'd better.
Splash down. Right, so Alan's back at the pool. He remembers the hydrotherapist he interviewed in Welcome to the Places of My Life, Annabelle Swanson. He says in the book, Swan Swim, which is what he says in the show.
Yeah, he hasn't learned.
He hasn't learned at all. And also, interestingly, when you go back to Welcome to the Places of My Life, her name is Swanson. He says Swan Swim, but on the graphics on the screen, it says Swam Swim. So he's got it wrong twice. Brilliant. So apparently his foot is so swollen. I keep saying apparently because I still don't believe him, for a Veruca sock. So what's the only logical solution? He's opened up 3 water bottles using a pair of scissors, and with the help of some gaffer tape, he's clad his foot in the bottle's rubber pelt to create a Veruca boot.
It's a massive booty, isn't it?
And all that's left to do is to lower himself into the water until the warm water laps at his back, flank and tits.
So Tom, in the APU, do you think Alan wasn't even hospitalised?
I don't. Because you're adding dramatic license to everything. Like, nothing really happens when he gets into the hospital, does it? Like, he's not actually treated for anything. He's just put on a drip. There's no real actual operation or process or medication that he has to take or anything.
So if I'm going to buy into your theory here, here's where it potentially works. He essentially ran out of time to finish the walk because he had to get back on air on Monday morning. So the only way he can justify that is, oh, my foot went septic and I had to be
hospitalized. He's written himself a fable of like a man against the odds.
Yeah.
He continues through injury. He gets enlightenment from like a lowly tramp. He meets Jesus in a vision and then he manages to basically more or less do everything.
So arguably there's no tramp, there's no foot injury, He just ran out of time.
At this point, I'm starting to wonder if there was even a walk.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that Alan Partridge is a fictitious character.
Well, my other thought was, you could even question, is his father even dead as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
Great
point.
Plot twist. So, the return of Dawn. She says, you've got a welly on, which Alan thinks might be thinks for a terrible, terrible split second that it's pensioner slang for an erection.
We've got some short bursts underwater crying from Alan here as well. She smiles at me. I feel tears pricking in my eyes. I sink back into the water so that the tears can mingle with it and no one will be able to tell me if I'm weeping or not.
Yep, so basically Alan spills to Dawn about his walk ordeal. And then as he's leaving the swimming baths in the car park, Dawn offers to take Alan to Dungeness.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
It is nice. It is nice. So I had a little look on the Dungeness Power Station visitors website. And according to the website, visits have to be booked at least 3 weeks in advance so they can carry out security checks so that he wouldn't have been able to rock up instantly. So it says on the website, for safety and security reasons, all visitors are required to provide some personal information designed to allow for background checks. So that's basically a photo ID, which you have to then send to them and present on the day in order to get access to the tour. So it has to be properly booked in and everything. So yeah, they wouldn't have been able to just turn up on the day and access the visitor centre.
Even if Alan throws his weight around, talks about North Norfolk Digital.
Fair enough, yeah, maybe.
And I think the walk was so recent that even if he'd applied for a permission right at the beginning, he still wouldn't have got it in time.
And then we learned that Alan daubed the word idiot on his dad's car. So I don't see how he can have any problems with people daubing cock-piss partridge on the side of his car. And that he also put dead flies in his dad's underpants drawer.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because in the chapter about his father, when he's saying things about he talks about things he would like to have done to him to kind of wreak some kind of payback on him, but he doesn't list the things he actually did do. So he's talking about setting a model aeroplane on fire and stuff like that, but none of this.
Alan says that he's going to sort of change his ways. He claims he's going to break the cycle and start being a bit nicer to people, that cycle being parents being horrible to their children. But then Alan says, maybe I've been nasty to my own kids from time to time. Although they weren't entirely blameless. Fernando was a liar and Denise could be quite sneaky. And then really the only sort of final thing that I have is that, as always, Alan has to win. He basically kind of makes up a version of reality to himself that to make it that he's beaten his dad and made it to the power station and that he never actually did. So, I think kind of with iPartridge, I would say that, I mean, I can sort of surmise this at the end, but I feel like they do rush endings a little bit and you don't really get the ending satisfaction that everything in the book has been leading up to, I would say, arguably.
Yeah,
and I guess one could argue that's perhaps intentionally a joke, that because obviously this walk was of quite little kind of consequence, so obviously it's a bit of a fizzle out at the ending.
Yeah. But I think that's okay as you go, but I think to have people in the real world pay for a book and then and then have a cop-out ending and say, well, yeah, but Alan's rubbish, so
especially if they spent 10 hours dissecting it as well.
It's not quite good enough.
I disagree because I don't think you're buying this for a narrative payoff. It's not really about the story, it's just about the jokes along the way. So I would just say, for me, I was it's not a particularly exciting ending, but it worked enough for me.
Yeah, and I think the kind of with the Gibbons brothers kind of saying like that in essence is the point, like him going to Dungeness is kind of the whole concept behind the walk. It's all just quite a bit bleak and unglamorous anyway. Mm-hmm. So even if he completed it, it still wouldn't be that much of an end, much of a significantly big ending, would it? I suppose.
So disappointingly, Dungeness Power Station is actually quite well reviewed on Google and TripAdvisor, so not much gold there in terms of one star reviews, but there is one review from...
Yeah, I'm glad that a nuclear power station doesn't get one star reviews.
No, it's the visitor centre.
Either way, I'm reassured.
I just wanted to have a look around and I came out covered in all this neon muck. Like the opening of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
There is one good review, though, that I picked out from a Nicholas Price, which says, brought here by Alan Partridge, and I can't say this enough, don't forget your sandwiches. Love to listen in the footsteps of my, brackets his, father. So obviously someone's listened to this or read this.
It's nice there's a couple of things along the way that have made their way into Google Maps.
Yeah.
Alan's yeah, basically Google infiltrating yeah, yeah, yeah. Google Maps.
That's all I've got on this chapter and I guess the ending of the book.
I think my favourite thing about this is that essentially the story begins and ends with Alan pushing Simon at a men's urinal.
Yeah, very nice.
Great bookends.
Yeah, really good.
So onto the epilogue.
Yep, chapter 31, epilogue. I think it's quite good that there's a epilogue and that the writers tie up some loose ends and we get an answer as to why Alan's dad didn't make it to the interview. Has anyone got the details on that?
You say details.
Yeah. I mean, he did make it, but he just did badly, didn't he? He was shit at the interview.
I love that just kind of like undermines the entire book yes. by just essentially saying... He didn't. He went to an interview. He didn't do very well. He didn't get the job. But Alan's performed this massive walk in aid of celebrating this monumental achievement, and actually, we just find out it was broadly all for nothing.
But I think that's the thing. It's obviously that's the conceit from the very beginning that this is all a big construct for Alan to try and generate some publicity and possibly a 6-part primetime TV show on BBC One. But by the time you get to the epilogue, even Alan's given up trying to defend that conceit. He's like, actually. You know, it seems like blood on a receipt. Nothing more, it seems, than a very bad nosebleed. It's like there is no significance to any of this.
The only material gain he's made from this entire journey is hiring Dawn as the assistant to his assistant. I would have loved to have seen a show like that. I like the idea of what would happen if Lynn was given a little bit of power over someone and whether she would treat them a bit more benevolently than Alan treats her.
We know that Dark Lynn is maybe that's always near the surface.
But maybe that's why we're seeing Dark Lynn in this time.
I also think it's a nice ending and it's nice to have Dawn in there, but I would have hoped for a more romantic ending because I think that would have been a nice way to kind of like... That's the end of Angela, and we start with a new chapter with this Dawn.
So you want Dawn. Romance between Alan and Dawn. That's what you want.
Yeah, I think it would have been a nice angle to take.
You want to hear about Alan tongue-shagging a 70-year-old?
Well, I think it would have been better if she wasn't geriatric and just...
She's his geriatric swim buddy, and you want them to get it on with
I'm
each
saying,
other.
Don't make her old. I think that could have been a nice angle there.
There is one detail that I like in how Alan finds out that his dad went for a terrible interview, which was Alan uses the money he refused to pay the branding consultant and hired students from the University of East Anglia as private investigators.
Brilliant.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we're at the end of Alan's story, but thankfully there is still quite a lot to this book.
Yeah. So there's one thing that I really, really like from the audiobook. So you go through, Alan finishes the book and then he goes through sort of like the credits where, you know, he says who it's by, who it's published by. And then there's a really nice little nugget about something that he's obviously kind of contractually obliged to do, which is read about sort of other publications by Orion Audio, or whatever. So I think it's really, really funny. So we'll just play that in now.
And read by Alan Partridge. The executive producer was Pandora White. This is a Strathmore Publishing production for Orion Audiobooks, produced and engineered by Richard Hughes and Chris Sharp. Text is copyright 2016 by Rob Gibbons, Neil Gibbons and Steve Coogan. The recording is copyright 2016 by the Orion Publishing Group and Hatchet UK Company. For information about other Orion audiobooks, visit the website at www.orionbooks.co.uk.
So, even though the book itself is finished, there's still some gold to be had. So there's an also by this author section, which some of the things in here we're aware about, some of the things we're not so aware about. So does anyone want to kind of go through those or...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, so a funny thing happened on the way to the stadium to Alan Partridge by Alan Partridge, 1992.
Now, we know that exists. Mm,
we yeah,
know
that's that. Been referenced before. Bouncing Back obviously speaks for itself, 2002. Forward Solutions, An Imbecile's Guide has a footnote to say it's been yet to be published, and that was obviously referenced earlier in Nomad. Yeah. iPartridge, we need to talk about Alan. We've covered in extensive detail. It came out in 2011. My favourite one, probably is the one that came next, Planning Application for Single Story Extension to Rear of Domestic Dwelling by Alan Partridge, 2012. That's literally just him trying to get a conservatory put on Denton Abbey, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Massive and brilliant.
I Wish to Make a Complaint, Collected Funny TripAdvisor Reviews by Alan Partridge, again, yet to be published.
Would read.
I think, I can't remember the exact number, but there's at least three references to TripAdvisor and people being rinsed or done over on it. So
yeah, I think clearly, there's even more than three. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
clearly been prepping yeah. that alongside writing this book. And then From the Quill of a Partridge, A Poetry Compendium by Alan Partridge, which is yet to be published in the UK, which suggests for some reason he's been commissioned elsewhere to write a poetry book.
Yeah, I'd like to know what country he has been published in. Yeah,
brackets YTBPITUK.
Yeah. I wonder if because that doesn't have a year on it. I wonder if that's something that maybe Sonia's talked him into and it's been published wherever Sonia came from.
Yeah, it's probably self-published. It's like fan fiction, isn't it? It's just up on the internet to be found by anyone that wishes to find it.
Yeah.
I'm also a big fan of the index, so there's some index
there's
highlights.
There's a sentence you don't
there.
Hear very often.
So I'll just pick out some highlights.
Can I just say that there is no index in the Kindle version, so I haven't seen any of this. So I hope this is as good as you're saying, Tom.
Yeah, there's some highlights to pick out, definitely, which include Bitches, Cromwell's, 33-197, Cherubs, Physical Strength and Aeronautical Capabilities, Corsadil Mouthwash, Brand Ambassadorship of... brackets by Corsadil Mouthwash, the best mouthwash there is, and finally my favourite, Motherfucker, comma, regrettable use of.
I also enjoyed Hadaway, A Man Who Looked Like.
Yeah. And Gibson Rudy, His Fun Anthrax Joke, 25, His Inability to Then Take a Joke, 26.
Finally, Netflix, Christ's Opinion On.
There is also doing my research for this, I found a blog or website that is actually part of something called they're basically people who review indexes, or they're like there's like an indexes society or association. They have like conferences and stuff like that where someone's done an actual serious breakdown and sort of a deep dive into the credits of this and iPartridge as well, which I'll share on the socials.
I'm still finding gold just looking at this index now. Another one I found is God, the Father, 6, 7, 26, 39, 47, 50, 55, 66, 67, 70, 126, 150, 165, 177, 178, 187, 190, 192, 196, 202, 229, 231, 255, 263, 264, the Son, 770, 115, 186, 250, 257, 261 to 3, 268, the Holy Spirit, not mentioned. And also, there's another one that's I, brackets Alan Partridge, pages 1 to 285, which is the entire book.
Nice. Brilliant.
That is brilliant.
So then the final thing is a notes section, and it's basically got 7 empty pages that Alan sort of explains.
Again, this bit is not in Kindle.
Okay.
And it's 5 pages in the paperback as well.
Okay. So, Adam, I believe you've got some notes on this.
Sure. Well, it's all to do with offset printing, apparently. So he's basically explaining, going into way too much detail about why there are blank pages. It's to do with the way the book's printed and the pages are inserted in groups of even numbers. He's put, what can I do? Cut 10 pages worth of copy to avoid starting a signature? No chance. Not going to happen, mate. I've cut too much as it is. Bulk it up with filler about walking, loft insulation or offset printing. Not my style. Say nothing and avoid drawing attention to it. No, I will do none of those things. And then he says that he basically gives the pages over to the reader to record any ideas. And if this has become a GCSE set text, teachers may use the pages to map out lesson plans.
I love that kind of... I love that writing style where it's like he's talking to somebody. He's like, no chance, mate, and stuff like that. It's like, who was he envisaging in his mind when he's writing those things? It's great.
So yeah, that's basically all the written word of Nomad covered. There is, of course, a photos section. There's two separate photo section within the book. There's some stuff that we've seen before, some new stuff which may or may not have had some Photoshop done on it. So I just wanted to open it out. Any particular highlights that people wanted to cover?
Well, I'm pleased to report that the photos do feature in the Kindle section, but right. They're all just lumped together as one at the end. Yeah, I enjoyed the bit where Alan writes about he was Photoshopped into several photos. He paid a GCSE design student to Photoshop him in. I was sadly unable to publish the selfies I'd taken on the journey because my face was too red. And I think he elaborates on how red his face gets whilst walking. So there are probably, I think, are there about three or four photos in this section where he's very clearly been Photoshopped in as an afterthought, and it's quite kind of unrealistically done.
Yep, and it's my understanding that art imitates life a little bit because they actually ran out of time during putting this book together to do an actual photo shoot with Steve in those locations. Mm. So they did have to Photoshop it for real anyway. There's a couple of things in the drawing of the Footsteps of My Father logo that I wanted to talk about. One is that if you look at the bottom of the photo, underneath the logo, it is a to-do list that says yeah. Call plumber, eggs, coat hangers, and then underlined stay positive. Also, he says right. he's not a very good drawer because he has a bad hand after he slammed it in a microwave door. Now, I'd like everyone to just imagine a microwave in front of you and try and work out the logistics by which you could slam your own hand in a microwave door. You would have to be you'd have to be slamming it with the other hand.
You have to use a lot of force to actually create
an injury.
The doors
aren't heavy. Like, it can't be done unless you're absolutely stupid.
Another one of my highlights is from the section about his childhood home, 12 Cecil Road, where he basically imagines, he has an imaginary friend who's a homeless person that lives inside the garden shed.
Hang on a minute. An imaginary friend who's a homeless person. So he's got previous.
Ah, yeah.
We've just blown this shit wide open.
Not called Brian, though. This one's called Eric. And he says that it's very important to not lose sight of the fact that Eric was trespassing. Also, he gets to a certain age and obviously he doesn't want to have an imaginary friend anymore. So rather than stop imagining his friend, he says that his homeless friend Eric develops cancer. And as an imaginary person, he has no access to the NHS. So he had no choice but to retreat to the shed and take matters into his own hands. On the 3rd of October 1966, Eric placed a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. A tragic end to a tragic life. He is survived by his wife Elsie, also imaginary.
So Alan having a really dark imagination where he can't control where it goes,
yep.
That has been consistent from very early life.
Yep. And then also the other thing from the Footsteps of My Father logo, you will also notice a tiny rugby ball sailing over the capital H because I realised it looked like rugby posts. I hadn't spotted that.
Oh, yeah.
And he writes, I forgot to mention it in the text in pages 77 to 78. The rugby ball was an idea I did ask to be included.
Did anyone enjoy anything about the shot of him in front of the Carphone warehouse offices and the scam that he basically pulls on local taxi drivers? He goes there and stays on for a cocktail reception sometimes when he's done motivational talks for them over the years. He says he has one of every drink, but it's a great system because by the time he begins to be unwell, he's off Carphone warehouse property and in the back of a taxi. And as he says, the cabbies don't like it, and I can appreciate why, but at the end of the day, there's absolutely nothing they can do.
I enjoyed the picture of Edmonds. So there's Edmonds looking exceptionally 80s. I don't think he'd look any more 80s if he tried.
Mm. Great shirt, lovely hair.
Yeah, basically.
Ewok head.
He talks about a time that Alan found one of his... Edmonds's notebooks in which he'd sketched out hairstyles, and that there was a lift to weight equation that basically detailed the amount of hairspray you would need to keep Noel's hair aloft, that supposedly was devised by 16th century art whiz Leonardo da Vinci. Although Alan does say at the end, I simply don't believe him.
I love that he's described Leonardo da Vinci as an art whiz.
Yeah,
fair enough.
And then the only thing, other thing that I've got is from the second section of pictures, where obviously in this time when Alan's iPad gets synced up to the digiwall, it goes to his photo gallery and up pops the hand-drawn picture of Michael. Obviously, when TTWAT went out, I hadn't read Nomad by that point, so I had no idea that that picture existed. So I got very excited when I saw that. Little did I know that it's just included in Nomad. Yeah, so. Yeah.
Well, I was excited because I recognised it from Nomad, so it works on both levels.
Yep.
There's a caption alongside the a pebble with a white circle, clearly struggling for photos now, alongside one of the M20 motorway, where he says he found this pebble next to a small collection of sticks in on the front doorstep of a house. He says they clearly belong to a small child or a grown-up with learning difficulties, but I didn't feel bad about stealing this one because I liked it and I wanted to have it, which I thought was extremely cold, even for Alan.
I mean, it's a good point to make that I think, obviously, an overarching joke in this section is a lot of the photos are shit and don't actually tell you anything of any significance.
Speaking of which, the William Harvey Hospital caption in Ashford is clearly just him trying to fulfil his contractual obligations. He says, it's not a great deal you can say about a hospital, especially one in which you are heavily sedated, but I'm contractually obliged to provide a caption for each photo and I'm happy to honour that. What follows is basically information you would get about this hospital from the hospital website or Google Maps or Wikipedia.
It's like the How to Get Here page or something
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's worth mentioning a quick quote from the Michael drawing where Alan writes, I never took a photograph of Michael because he found flashes frightening and I don't know how to turn the flash off on my cell phone.
Great.
Oh, and also my therapist said, so speaking of the illustration, my therapist says his eyes seem to follow you around the room and I'm thrilled to have captured that because it's something they used to do to women in real life, especially if he was drunk.
Hang on, Alan's therapist?
Yeah.
Alan has a therapist. Did we know that?
Another little bombshell tucked away at the end of the book.
I missed that completely.
Yeah, no.
Oh, actually, that could be a really good idea for an Alan-based program where, you know, kind of, what was that? It was called Help, wasn't it? The show where Paul Whitehouse played a therapist and
I don't know.
He didn't play the therapist. He played people going to a therapist.
The
and he played lots of different characters going to therapy, and which was a really good show. So it would be a series where Alan, week by week goes to see a therapist and like basically talks through his issues
like
and
week
problems.
One, Grandad Graham.
Yeah. Oh, that, I think that'd be really good.
Anyone else got anything else on pictures? I've got one key highlight for me.
Go for it.
Well, Alan actually has quite a long section about the London Container Terminal. And I was just
what we've all been waiting for.
Strap in, listeners.
I was quite keen to read out this paragraph. I think you guys will see why. I'm told that in London, the hipsters or trendies have taken to using old shipping containers as offices or retail space. A lot of people think this is cool, but in actual fact, it's not. These containers have earned the right to a dignified retirement. They've spent their lives in the service of commerce, crisscrossing the seven seas, often in perilous conditions. What have millennials ever done apart from a bit of freelance graphic design work? Pathetic. Question to the group, where are we recording this very podcast? In Container City, ladies
in a
and gentlemen.
Lovely container.
So basically, so Alan has just outed Jed as a hipster.
Jed is a London hipster and a trendy, and he's pathetic.
Yeah. And he hasn't even done any graphic design work.
Right, so if that's everything on the photos section, I think it's time for, I guess, a roundup and general thoughts on the book and, you know, what we thought and whatever we found that had been written online about it. So, yeah, let's crack into that.
So we asked you, dear listeners, for your feedback on the book, and we are pleased to share some of your thoughts with you. So I'll start with Tom Stab.
Yep, Dave Hughes says, absolutely love Nomad. For me, I'm a big fan of the section where he talks about using a B&B's Wi-Fi to slag them off on TripAdvisor. We like that bit as well. The section on Gary Wilmot's wedding fry-up, and of course the chapter on Edmonds. I listen to it every night on Audible to send me to sleep.
Rachel Clark says, absolutely loved Nomad. Best thing since sliced bread.
Adam Howes said, I honestly think Nomad was better than I'm Alan Partridge.
Wow.
And that, I mean, that is big talk. Love this book. Really hope we get another book in the AP verse. Obviously, he means the APU.
Gaz Rowley Jones says, audiobook of this is brilliant, which I definitely agree with. It certainly is.
David O'Reilly, one word, Edmonds.
Kieran Parr says, disregard the entire Brian section.
Does that mean disregard it as fact or disregard it? It's not very good.
I think he doesn't like it.
Yeah, right, okay. Which I would disagree with, but I think that's what he's saying.
Right, okay.
Robert Neville said his favourite bit was the Tony Cloak section.
Barnaby Cook just says, script, script, script.
Scott Catania, sorry if I pronounced that wrong. Careful, there's anthrax in there.
Rob Frost says, I love Alan's pioneering self-motivation tools, e.g. climb to the top of this rope or Grandad kills himself.
Grandad Graham. James Bancroft wrote, the chapter at the swimming pool is incredible. That's my favourite bit.
Stuart Filmer and Sean Wright both said that Quaddy the Water Monster was their highlight.
I mean, as a highlight of the book, that's basically just one word. Yeah, there's no description of what Quaddy is. So Lee Milne got in touch with us and was kind of doing a blow by blow as he was listening to it live via separate messages. So I'll read a couple out now. 90 minutes into the audiobook, he's still deliberately ignorant that Simon was adopted, but I'm loving it. I feel like Rambo at the top of the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum. Follow up, only 30 minutes left. Brilliant book. The owners of the B&B were gay, so their humour wasn't for him. Next message, and Gordon is dead.
Spoiler.
Genuinely shocked.
Robert Jebb says, I've read I, Partridge 18 times and Nomad 19. Bit of a hint of I've got 104 friends about yeah. that. Proof then that Nomad is one better than I, Partridge. Best part, too many. But Alan talking us through the design of his logo for the walk that's as snazzy as it is challenging is super.
Connor McKillen wrote, Nomad is a work of art. The index of the book showing all those partridgisms is a stroke of genius.
Colm Molhall says, for the Noel Edmonds chapter alone, Nomad is a worthy part of the AP canon. It had me laughing so hard I had Kenko coming out of my nostrils.
And Adrian Bavister says, I loved the prologue. So funny. Classic Alan to describe walking in such detail. A masterclass from the writers. Also loved all of the footnotes. Looking forward to hearing you speculate on The Man in the Park. It's been a while since I read it, but I seem to remember wondering at the time if it was Alan's dad.
Now that's a big theory, isn't it?
Possible. Alan's dad turns up alive to... Oh, I see what...
Brian.
Is he saying he's alive, or he's saying he's turned up as a vision?
Oh, well, I'm reading that as he's implying that his dad is basically a homeless in Gravesend.
Wow. I mean, it would tie in nicely in your with your suggestion of Steve Coogan playing... Brian the Tramp, so he got like Steve Coogan playing Alan's dad.
Yeah.
Who the hell is that?
So that's what you thought of it so far. Obviously, do keep your feedback coming and we'll round it up in future episodes. But thanks to those of you that got in touch. It's time to take a look at the critical acclaim and the reviews for Nomad around the time that it came out. Tom Stab, I believe, has some intel on that.
Yep. The Guardian called it glorious and the Telegraph said, gave it 5 stars and said the funniest book of the year, which I believe appears as a quote on the actual paperback, I believe.
Yes.
Or in the book, sorry.
It's on the back. Funny book of the year from the Sunday Telegraph.
There you go. That was the general consensus that it was critically well reviewed. And if you go on Amazon, if you go on Goodreads, similar sort of ratings.
What's the Amazon star rating?
It's 4.5 stars from 333 customer reviews.
I assume 4 out of 5 seems fair.
So we know what you, the listener, thought, and now we know what the critics thought, but it's time to talk about what we thought about Nomad, the Alan Partridge book, and where it fits into the scheme of things. Who would like to kick us off?
Sure. I mean, I think I really enjoyed it, and I've read through it quite a few times. As always, I think we'd all agree, same with I, Partridge, the audiobook is the best experience
Definitely.
Of this, because you're getting Coogan in full character. It's hard to decide what I think I liked more out of this and I, Partridge. I think probably I, Partridge, because it's kind of grounded in retelling his version of stuff that we know so well, which actually makes me think, personally, I'd love to see a televised version of this.
Agreed.
I think you could have a lot of fun with that. And yep. I think the Gibbons brothers don't really agree, which I think is a bit of a shame. I could really visualise lots of these sections working as a TV show.
The feeling I get is that this reservations about whether this could work on TV, because a lot of it is about the gap between what Alan is saying is happening and what is actually happening. And I guess on screen, that gap is harder to establish.
Yeah, I guess that basically just means it'd be hard work for them to make it, to make it work as a script. But I don't know, reading it, I think there are definitely a lot of sections where I could really visualize it working. But I think ultimately with everything like this, what I love about it is it's just creating that rich backstory where they're really... they're really cementing certain character traits. And I just love the fact, you know, you've got this constant unreliable narrator thing. You've got these consistent crap celebrities popping up. The really forced nature of the footsteps walk itself. Like, he hates walking, isn't really that close to his father, full stop. And basically the whole joke of the conceit being it really serves no purpose and nothing will actually come of it.
I would say personally that I preferred this to I, Partridge.
Mm.
I think the reason being that I, Partridge is brilliant, and obviously it was the first time that we saw Alan in the written form, and there were loads of kind of literary techniques and styles that we hadn't really seen before, so that was really funny, and that's obviously continued into this. But there was a lot of repetition in terms of the stories that you'd kind of heard before. Mm-hmm. And there is a little bit of repetition in Nomad, but what I liked about this was that the through line, or the story that sort of underpinned this, was completely original. And I feel like there's more original Partridge in this than there is in iPartridge, and I think for that reason I preferred it. And I'm kind of a bit disappointed with myself that it took me so long to read it.
Can I just say, I told you guys literally years ago that it was great.
Yep, but I came to it a lot later, so I only read it this year, and I must admit that's a bit of a failing on my part, because yep. I think I will definitely return to this. I mean, I've listened to it in the run-up to this easily 6 times, and I will definitely continue to listen to it, but for me, it just pips iPartridge, just.
Hang on a minute. 6 times? This means it's the most prepared for a series you've ever, ever, ever been.
That's what you're hearing.
Yeah. The numbers speak for themselves.
Yeah. I'm just genuinely shocked.
My thoughts, I mean, generally excellent. To your point, I think I prefer iPartridge slightly more. Again, like, both are really great. I would say iPartridge is 10 on 10. This is a 9 out of 10. The only reason I prefer iPartridge a little bit was, I think, partly due to the reason that I'd never heard him in audiobook form before. So having that as kind of almost new Partridge was just a really nice new way of hearing it. And it was like a pleasant surprise. I kind of compare it to sort of the Guardians of the Galaxy film, in that no one was expecting it. And when it comes, it kind of takes everyone by surprise. And almost that surprise factor that it's good is almost kind of elevates it in itself.
Question, do you think, and I might be slightly guilty of this as well, do you think you might prefer iPartridge slightly because there's more familiarity with it? You know, you've lived with it for longer.
Maybe.
You've definitely heard it or read it more times as well.
Maybe. I just think in general it's a slightly better book because it's kind of good for old school Alan fans, in that it talks about a lot of stuff that we know about, and this is all new. Not to say that it's bad in any way, shape or form. Like I said, I think it's generally excellent. And I think I completely agree with you, Tom, that it could have worked as a TV show. Very visual. There's some good sort of slapstick moments. There's classic Alanisms that I think would have worked well in TV format or special format. Classic Alan mishaps, lots of gold, and just generally there were lots of sort of moments and gags and like I say, Alanisms that really made me laugh out loud a lot. So yeah, like Nick, I will keep returning to it because I think it's great. I think it's going to be one of those things that will be quite good to listen to at night to go to sleep if you're familiar with it. It's
the soothing sounds of Coogan.
Exactly. A soothing sounds of Alan. Yeah, it's generally brilliant. And again, I think the sentiment around the table, and I think from fans as well, is that Alan really works in the book format. As long as the conceit is right and Coogan does the audiobook, I think there's definitely room for more Alan books. But obviously it's getting around to writing them or whatever, but he definitely works in the literary form, and I'm keen to see more Alan books.
See, I think I'm slightly cooler on it than everyone else. I think Nomad is very impressive, even more so when I realised it was basically written in 6 weeks. That's a pretty good turnaround.
We have that on good authority, don't we?
Good authority. I think some of it works because they can go on such random tangents and wander off topic and lose their place, and it's covered by Alan's own ineptitude. But I do think that's perhaps been used a bit too much. There are, like we were talking about, the slightly deflated ending of the book is kind of, you can explain it away by saying, well, it's just Alan being a bad writer, but that doesn't make up for it being a slightly disappointing experience, the end of the book. I've got to say, I don't find written Alan or even audiobook Alan quite as funny as on-screen Alan. I can see why the book's great and I can appreciate why people enjoy it, but I need his mannerisms, I think, for the full effect. And also, much as you hear interviews with like Armando and those guys talking about when they're writing this stuff, it drives them crazy because it's like being in a room with Alan for 8 hours. Reading this book or listening to the audiobook is an awful long time to spend in that universe.
In the mind of Alan.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking as someone who's now, what, clocked up 75 odd episodes of talking about Alan.
Oh, more.
I do find living in book world Alan a little bit too much in one go for me.
You'd rather stick with a 28-minute chunk, basically.
I think so, yeah. Or at least feel free to kind of dip in and out rather than kind of go for something quite so lengthy. At one point, we heard that the plan for this book had been a collection of failed business ideas and letters and other correspondence. And I'm glad it's not that, because that has the bit of a smell of a cash-in to it. And that's what lesser shows have done. So yeah, I also think the pacing could have been a little bit better, but I gather that a lot of it they were writing as they go, and the book was commissioned before there was a firm idea. I don't want to be too down on it. I think it's very funny and it's really amusing, but it doesn't kind of have me in stitches in the same way that a TV show would, and I think that's where Alan really thrives.
Yeah, one kind of additional point I think that's worthy of making is, I quite like that with the audiobooks, you tend to think with an audiobook you need to listen to it from beginning to end, whereas I think one of the beauties of these books is you can just listen to like the Gatwick candidate as a chapter, yep. and it works. Just you don't need the context. You could just listen to the Edmonds chapter, or the Swallow episode in Armand and Partridge. Basically, you can dip in and dip out of it, and I think that is to its credit that actually you can just pick out the highlights. You don't need to go through all 6 hours of it. So to your point, you don't need to have just 6 hours of
it. You can create your own best of the book, can't you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I mean, I as well, to give it its credit, I can't think of any other kind of comedy property that began on radio and TV and has translated so well over to books. But that doesn't mean that books is where this belongs.
Oh, no, I completely agree that TV Alan is the best Alan. I, you know, that want to make that absolutely clear. But the audio is a welcome second.
So yeah, that's our thoughts on Nomad. Thank you so much for those of you that have joined us over the last few months to tackle it alongside us. We hope that you go back to it with fresh eyes and perhaps enjoy it all over again. It goes without saying that we'll be back with future Alan projects. There's new Alan in the pipeline, we know, a series being recorded probably at around the time that you are listening to this podcast. So we should be back to cover that in the new year. And there's also a few tidbits of Alan that we've left on the cutting room floor that we'll gather up and present in future. If you'd like to get in touch in the meantime, it's thepartridgepod@gmail.com. We're on facebook.com/thepartridgepod. Twitter, it's @thepartridgepod. Instagram, @monkeytennispod. And the Monkey Tennis hotline is open 24/7 for all your Alan venting needs. 07923 600 017. Thanks so much for those of you who've joined us on this series, and also those of you that have stuck with us through 75 plus episodes. God bless you.
We're into the 80s by now.
So what was it, Tom? We've got more episodes than Game of Thrones.
We've got
now.
More episodes than Game of Thrones, which means we are better than Game of Thrones. Yeah.
And also, this is our 8th series, so we're hoping it doesn't prompt a similar backlash. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Gotta go. Should we walk home?
Anyway, I think that's everything. All right then. Thank you. I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Lava on him, Knowlesy.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker.
Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.